This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and we hope you had a good weekend because it wasn't exactly that in Quebec.
The United States has been taken advantage of for decades and decades, and we can't do that anymore. We had extremely productive discussions on the need to have fair and reciprocal, meaning the same. People can't charge us 270%, and we charge them nothing. That doesn't work anymore.
It was a contentious 2 days at the G7 summit in Canada, where President Trump derided our allies for what he calls unfair trade policies. And he blamed the failure of these deals on past American presidents.
The United States leaders of the past didn't do a good job on trade. And again, I'm not blaming countries. I'm blaming our people that represented our past. It's going to change. It's going to change. I mean, it's not a question of I hope it changes. It's going to change 100%. And tariffs are going to come way down because people cannot continue to do that. We're like the piggy bank that everybody's robbing, and that ends.
In response, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said his country would impose retaliatory tariffs.
Applying equivalent tariffs to the ones that the Americans have unjustly applied to us. I have made it very clear to the president that it is not something we relish doing, but it is something that we absolutely will do because Canadians, we're polite, we're reasonable, but we also will not be pushed around.
And then it got ugly. From Air Force One, President Trump called Justin Trudeau, quote, very dishonest and weak, and said he would not honor a joint statement agreed upon by all parties. The president's top advisors used even stronger language. Here's Peter Navarro, the White House trade advisor, speaking on Fox News Sunday.
There's a special place in hell for any foreign leader that engages in bad faith diplomacy with President Donald J. Trump and then tries to stab him in the back on the way out the door. And that's what bad faith Justin Trudeau did with that stunt press conference.
Now Trump is in Singapore with another shot at diplomacy, this time with North Korea. But before the talks get underway, there's a mountain of work to be done to prepare for a meeting of this magnitude with two mercurial world leaders. For his part, President Trump says he's ready. And he was asked how long it would take to figure out Kim Jong-un.
I think within the first minute, I'll know.
How?
Just my touch, my feel. That's what I do. How long will it take to figure out whether or not they're serious? I said maybe in the first minute. You know, the way they say that you know if you're going to like somebody in the first 5 seconds. You ever hear that one?
David Scheer is the former U.S. ambassador to Vietnam and assistant secretary of defense. He was the deputy director of the Korea desk during Madeleine Albright's 2000 visit to Pyongyang, and he's currently senior advisor to McLarty Associates. He says the president's remarks underplay the amount of work that goes into pulling off a summit of this magnitude.
The United States needs the diplomatic leverage that our allies can provide. And it's not just the EU, Canada, and Mexico, but it's Japan and South Korea as well. Because the actions the president has taken on trade affect our Northeast Asian allies just as negatively as they affect our other allies. And this may well have an effect both on the North Koreans and on the Chinese.
David, I'm curious, you know, just a couple of months ago, the president and North Korea were essentially at odds and threatening, you know, what some said could have been a nuclear war. Now we're at this stage of the summit. Is this a stunt? Is it a political stunt? And if so, who has what to gain? What does North Korea have to gain out of this?
Well, it's anything but a political stunt in real terms. The peace and security of Northeast Asia depend in part on the outcome of this summit. So it's no surprise that all the world is watching how President Trump and President Kim do in this summit.
And let's talk a little bit about, in your experience, what it takes for past presidents to prepare for meetings like this.
It takes a great deal of preparation, not only by the staff, but by the principal, him or herself. Certainly, Secretary of State Albright did her homework before going to Pyongyang in the year 2000. You've got to be very careful, in particular, with the North Koreans, who are always interested in upstaging you and ensuring that their legitimacy is ensured by their encounter with the senior American official. And that's one thing that one concession that the president has made right up front by treating President Kim Jong-un as an equal. Another concession he's made, apparently, is to take a step-by-step approach to North Korean denuclearization. So the Americans come into this summit having made two big concessions. Now it's time for the North Koreans to deliver something.
And how realistic, quite frankly, is it that the North Koreans will deliver something, whether that's in the form of denuclearization? And if so, how far is it expected to be?
Well, the North Koreans have already shut down their test site, but it's not clear that that test site was of any further use after the large hydrogen bomb explosion of last year. So the North Koreans, I think, will be ready to make some concessions. But the question is, when and by how much will they be willing to denuclearize? And that's going to be only be known down the road.
I'm speaking with former Ambassador and Assistant Defense Secretary David Scheer about the upcoming summit with North Korea. Other than the, I mean, obviously this isn't a small thing, denuclearization, but I'm just curious about what else are the president's political goals with this summit?
Well, I'm sure the president wants to demonstrate to the world that he's the great man who could unravel this knot that so many of his predecessors have failed to unravel. He's also looking to, I suspect, looking to readjust our alliance relationship with the ROK over the course of these negotiations. The North Koreans are going to want concessions on the extent to which we exercise militarily with the ROK, as well as the extent of our military presence there. So how the president manages these issues will reflect on not only the denuclearization issue, but the future reunification of the Korean Peninsula and the international order in Northeast Asia.
We did have news that two administration officials told NBC News that the United States decided not to bring up human rights at the summit. Your reaction to that?
I think human rights should be a fundamental part of our negotiating position with the North Koreans. North Korea is a human rights disaster, and it needs to be raised at the highest levels. How the president raises and in what context during the meeting should be up to him, of course. But we can't let the North Koreans forget that this is a fundamentally important issue for the United States.
And obviously, we have to talk about what success looks like here. What is success for the North Koreans? What would success look like for the Americans, for the United States?
Well, the president going in has described this meeting as a getting to know you session. And I think that's a good approach that sets expectations at a realistic level. I think a success for this meeting would be a good statement of principles in a joint declaration that both sides agree to. And I think they should establish a framework within which we can negotiate denuclearization down the road.
David Scheer is a former U.S. ambassador to Vietnam and Assistant Secretary of Defense. He was the deputy director of the Korea desk during Madeleine Albright's 2000 visit to Pyongyang, and he's currently senior advisor to McLarty Associates. David, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tanzina.
The Supreme Court has issued a decision on one of the major voting rights cases on their docket this year about purging voter rolls in Ohio. In a 5-4 decision, the court ruled that Ohio could remove people who had not voted in 6 years and had not answered a mailed confirmation notice during that time. Josh Gerstein is a senior reporter for Politico. Josh, thanks for coming back.
Hey, happy to be with you, Tanzina.
So let's talk about the case that started it all.
So it's out of Ohio and involves the process that Ohio uses for what people call purging their voter rolls. But other states use similar processes. And this was really a test of what states are required to do, or as some might think, what they can get away with when they're going through this process of trying to cull out people from the voter rolls who maybe have moved, died, or for whatever other reason might not be eligible to vote anymore.
Now, a lot of the impetus for this, from what I understand, is also a question of stopping voter quote-unquote fraud, right? I mean, we don't see that many instances of voter fraud. Is this politically motivated or racially motivated?
It's hard to say exactly what people's motivations are. You're right, there is a specific element on the right, a fairly conservative element that's been pushing this voter fraud issue for some time. It often involves concerns about allegedly illegal immigrants of voting, although the evidence of that kind of thing, especially in person, is pretty limited. But Congress has put some provisions in the law that do call on states to do some things to police their voter rolls. And the question really is, what are they allowed to do under those provisions?
Now, this, of course, was the first voting rights case that Justice Neil Gorsuch heard on the bench. What does this tell us, or does this give us any insight into how this court may rule on upcoming gerrymandering cases, for example?
I'd say it's limited insight. I mean, the opinion, Gorsuch joined with all the Republicans in this 5-4 decision. It went pretty much entirely along party lines. The gerrymandering decisions are expected to be potentially a little bit different. It's really Justice Anthony Kennedy's vote that hangs in the balance there. And he's somebody who has said previously that he has pretty serious concerns about partisan gerrymandering and would be willing to block it if he saw a case where he thought it would be sort of a judicially manageable process to do it.
Now, there's been a lot of talk, obviously, about voting in recent years, particularly after this last election. And one of the things that's come up is automatic registration, right? Incentivizing voters and Americans to go to the polls. This would appear to have the opposite effect, or no?
Yeah, it is kind of the opposite effect. I don't know that it would prohibit automatic registration, but it's an interesting way in which this process of trying to strip voters from the rolls can have a disparate impact on different communities. You can imagine some minority communities say that they may move for various reasons. Perhaps more often, younger people, just as a general matter, tend to move more often than older folks. And there's also buried in here a little bit of a technological divide. There may be some young people that just don't respond to these mailed snail mail notices that they get. I know a lot of young people that don't take mail anywhere. And so maybe it's something the system just needs to modernize for the 21st century.
And from what we understand, this is one of the most aggressive states to purge its rolls in Ohio. Are voters in Ohio or potential voters aware of the limitations on their ability to vote?
I doubt it. I mean, they may become aware when they try to go in to vote in an election thinking they're registered and then finding out that they're not. But given the picture that was painted of some of these folks not responding to mailings they've received, to successive mailings, I guess we should say to mailings that we don't know for sure whether they received or not, it's hard to know whether people are really in the loop or really aware of the process. I would say a lot of the people fighting over this process are certainly well aware of keeping themselves registered. It really becomes a question of folks that are perhaps more loosely tied to the political process and what's going to happen on those occasions when they decide to dip their toe into the water and actually cast a ballot.
And I guess finally, would this signal to other states that will follow suit, do you think?
Oh, yeah, I think this will definitely be a signal that will embolden the voter fraud or anti-voter fraud crusaders in different states. It's been a decades-long concern of many advocates on the right to try to police the voter rolls. And it wouldn't surprise me at all to see a more aggressive move on this front by people who feel emboldened by the Supreme Court decision.
Josh Gerstein is a senior reporter for Politico. Josh, thanks again.
Sure, Tanzina. Take care.
FDC SeaTac. It's a federal prison located 12 miles south of Seattle. It's a 7-story gray building with narrow slots for windows and 4 distinct but connected units. 912 male and female inmates from every security level are currently housed there. But this month saw the arrival of a new group.
So what we know right now is that we have 209 people being held at the Federal Detention Center in SeaTac, Washington. We understand that 177 of them are women and 32 of them are men. They're all seeking asylum. And so this is unusual because it's not usually where people are being held when they're doing an asylum process.
That's Jorge Barón, the executive director of the Northwest Immigration Rights Project. He's been talking to some of the 209 immigrants in ICE detention who are now being transferred to a federal prison in Washington state, part of a new agreement between ICE and the Justice Department.
Most of the people that we talked to so far are from one of 3 countries, from Guatemala, El Salvador, or Honduras. We've talked to 11 women so far. 7 of them are mothers who had their children taken away from them at the southern border and who still have not been reunified with them. And now, of course, they're geographically much further apart because we understand that the children are being held in Texas. There's 2 women that I talked to personally. One of them is somebody who has got an 11-year-old. And, you know, she told the story about the fact that she basically turned herself in and her daughter when they came across the border. And then, you know, as they entered the station and they went down this hallway, at a certain point, without much warning, they were basically told, okay, you mother go this way and you daughter go the other way. And that was it. No warning, no chance to say goodbye. And they were separated. And the mother is distraught. She hasn't, you know, seen or heard from the daughter since that time. That was about 4 weeks ago. You know, she kept asking him, you know, how soon am I going to be reunified with my daughter? And I didn't have an answer. And I still don't have an answer to that question.
In total, 1,600 detainees are being transferred to federal prisons. Sarah Lynch is a criminal justice correspondent for Reuters, and she broke the story. Sarah, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah, why are immigrant detainees being transferred to federal prisons?
Well, you know, I spoke with a spokeswoman for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and she had told me that they just needed more space. They're launching what they call a zero-tolerance policy for people coming over the border illegally. So the Justice Department has also vowed that they will prosecute each person, and they don't want to let them be released while they await a civil immigration proceeding, as had been done in the past in some cases with nonviolent detainees. So They basically ran out of space, and they came to an agreement with both the Federal Bureau of Prisons and the U.S. Marshals Service. But what I could tell from the way I learned the story, I basically learned it through unions representatives who have workers in the prisons. It was sort of ad hoc, done last minute, and none of them really had much more than a few days' notice that these detainees were coming.
I mean, is this setting a precedent for housing these folks who are seeking asylum in prisons, in federal prisons?
Well, it has been done before, but for the most part, you know, I spoke with a lot of different people who are members of the union for the prison workers, and basically none of them could recall anything of this scale, of this magnitude, of this many people at once. And again, I think one of the biggest issues here is the fact that it was done seemingly last minute, with little planning, little telling the people in advance that this was happening, any of the infrastructure that you sort of need in a detainment facility. So there's reports that people can't get access to lawyers easily. They're not sure about how they're going to set up visitation, and it's very challenging for the people who are being detained there to be able to access legal assistance.
And I'm wondering how much you can tell us about the logistics of once these people who are seeking asylum are put into these federal prisons. Are they separate from the general population of incarcerated individuals? Are these folks sort of having to fend for themselves in that situation?
Well, they're going to be housed separately. They're supposed to be housed separately. I think each facility may be a little bit different in the setup. You know, in SeaTac, which you mentioned at the beginning, that is a high rise, so they're on different floors. But what I was told about the Victorville prison, which is out in California, about 85 miles away from Los Angeles, while they're separate there as far as where they're housed, there is a certain level of integration, I was told, because, for instance, when they go to eat in the mess hall.
And these are supposed to be temporary arrangements, right? 120 days. Is that the case?
Yeah, it's supposed to be 120 days, although one union member told me he's concerned because they're not increasing the number of people in the prisons to help deal with this influx. So we'll have to see what happens after 120 days. ICE is trying to secure additional facilities and space.
Now, we're hearing a lot about parents being separated from their children, forcibly separated from their children. What does that apply to this group that is being transferred to federal prisons? And if so, where are their children going?
We have limited visibility into that. Of all the facilities, there's five prisons that are being used in this agreement. Only one of them has women. That's the SeaTac facility. All the others have men. And I haven't so far in my reporting, although I'm hoping to find more examples of nonprofit legal advocacy groups that are trying to do outreach and try to figure out who's there, which is a challenge if you don't have the names of the person. I think they're speaking with the consulates to try to figure out who is there.
Well, that's another question I was going to ask you. How are people keeping track of who's there?
You know, they're being assigned what they're called register numbers, but if you don't know the register number, as is what Jorge Barron was telling me when I interviewed him, it's very hard to figure out who's there. He had spoken with me again yesterday to update me about what he's been seeing, and they've been working with consulates to try to figure out who's there. At last, he'd seen, and he'd said at this point, since he spoke with you, I think they've seen now more than 20 women. And they're estimating at least half of those are parents. A lot of them came in Texas. Quite a number of them had their children separated. We don't know at this point, and I haven't heard any reports yet, to see what's happening in these other facilities. You've got people in Sheridan, Oregon. You have people in Phoenix, Arizona, up to 1,000 people in Victorville, and then in Texas. And those are all male detainees.
Now, we reached out to ICE for comment, and they said that the reason they're doing this is because of the, quote, current surge in illegal border crossings and implementation of U.S. Department of Justice's zero tolerance policy. Now, I'm curious to ask you, where is this surge coming from? Because the data shows that if we're talking about Mexico, there's actually been a decrease in the number of people crossing the border.
You know, that's a good question. I think it may just be the fact that this administration is cracking down. You know, under Obama, in the beginning of that administration, they were cracking down as well, but that subsided amid, in part, a lot of criticism. So I don't know exactly where that's coming from. I could tell you, though, that ICE had told me that the average daily population of what they're housing in terms of number of people is over 41,000 as of May 26th, which is higher than what it was for the average last year. So they're housing a lot more people. And according to them, they're actually housing more people than the amount that Congress authorized them to pay for. So they need, according to them, you know, more resources and more beds.
Sarah Lynch is a criminal justice correspondent for Reuters who broke the story earlier this week. Sarah, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What does a man do?
What is it to be a man?
The notion of what a man should be like.
It's very confusing.
Be a man.
It's not quite what you think it is.
Whatever happened to Gary Cooper, the strong, silent type?
In order to be a man, they've got to separate their hearts from their heads.
There's a part of them crying out for the incorporation of the monster within them.
What is best in life? To crush your enemies and to hear the lamentation of your women.
Most of the violent crimes that happen are not committed by women, committed by men.
What does it mean to be a man?
It ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward.
Men, you have work to do.
This month on The Takeaway, we're going to look closely at what it means to be a man in 2018. And we want to hear from you.
My name is Joe from Philadelphia. Traditional definitions no longer capture all of masculinity, but I know that men nonetheless impose these upon each other, and women are guilty of imposing images of masculinity upon us as well. So it is something of a struggle, particularly as men grapple with losing their masculine privilege, along with the clear ideas of what masculinity entails.
How important is masculinity to your identity? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or write to us on our Facebook page. And thanks. The grainy black and white surveillance video shows a Mexican congressional candidate posing for a photo after a debate. All of a sudden, the footage shows a person quickly approaching the candidate and shooting him in the back of his head. The candidate, Fernando Purón, was a former mayor who vowed to be tough on crime if elected. But Purón is not the only candidate to be assassinated in the lead-up to the Mexican elections. According to a Mexican security firm, 112 politicians, candidates, and incumbents have been killed since September. Elections from local municipal seats to the presidency are scheduled for July 1st. Joining us to help understand the upcoming elections and the incredible amount of violence is freelance journalist Alice Driver, based in Mexico City. Alice, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And it's really interesting that you mentioned Purón, because he's somebody who I recently interviewed Ginger Thompson, who's a reporter for ProPublica, who's done some really amazing work on violence in Mexico. And she had interviewed him before he was murdered, and he said he was getting rid of drug assassins in the border town where he was mayor. And then shortly after that, he was assassinated. So he is just one of the mostly local politicians that have been murdered in this election cycle.
Now, tell us, and Ginger's fantastic. Her work is amazing. Tell us about the staggering number of murders that we're seeing. Is a 112 is just insane when you think about it. But is that the highest that you've seen? Are we at a peak right now?
Yeah, statistically speaking, violence against people running for office has spiked this year. And the thing that I think is always interesting, I think, for outsiders or people who are not in Mexico, is that this violence is really directed at local politicians often in tiny border towns, or a lot of the violence has happened in states like Guerrero, Oaxaca, Puebla, and Veracruz, which are states that already have high levels of violence against politicians, but also against journalists. And so I think it's really important to bring in that aspect of, well, thinking about freedom of press in combination with violence against officials, elected officials, and those running for office.
And I think, and my count may be inaccurate, but I think has it been a half a dozen journalists so far this year that have been killed in Mexico?
It is. It's actually 6 journalists so far this year. So that is correct.
Now, who is committing these murders? Is this drug cartel related? Is there another group behind this?
The constant discourse, both in Mexico and in the U.S. media, is that most of this violence is committed by drug cartels. But the reality in Mexico is a lot more complicated, because most drug cartels are made up of a combination of members from the army, from the police. There is a certain level of state buy-in in all of this violence, which is what's really sort of more difficult to parse out.
And how do you survive this level of violence? I mean, are there, you know, we've seen the Committee to Protect Journalists, for example, is trying to bring attention to the issue for journalists. But what can political candidates do right now to save themselves?
Well, there's been a lot of discussion about security, because especially, just imagine a small town, Mexico, candidates, they often don't have security. And even when they request it, maybe it's not immediately provided. And it's been sort of interesting, because López Obrador, who's the front runner for the presidency, he has been campaigning without visible security. And so that's something that people have noted. But he also is campaigning, saying that he's not going to force military confrontation with drug cartels, which has been the policy of the last 2 presidents, really. So he's saying, you know, whatever you're doing, I'm not going to confront it directly with military force. And so does that make him less likely to experience violence? I'm not sure. But I do think it's interesting that he has really not had that visible of a security detail.
I think that's a very interesting point, and we'll obviously be paying attention to these elections. Alice Driver is a freelance journalist based in Mexico City. Thanks, Alice.
Thanks for having me.
The Men's World Cup starts this week, and while the United States did not qualify, people all over the world will be heading to Russia for the biggest sporting event on the planet. By the way, you're listening to the official World Cup anthem called Live It Up. The games will kick off Thursday with Russia against Saudi Arabia, and neither of those teams are favored to make it out of the group stage. But don't look too hard for Team USA, because they didn't even qualify. Reigning champion Germany is favored to win the whole thing, and other top contenders include Brazil, France, and Argentina. But there's a dark reality underlying this year's games. Jules Boykoff is a former professional soccer player and professor of politics and government at Pacific University in Oregon, and he says there's a deep history of racism in Russian soccer.
It's long, and it's been well documented by groups like the London-based FAIR Network that track these sort of things. And it's serious business what's gone on there. There's often bananas thrown on the field at players of African descent. There's monkey chants are commonplace. Last year in the tournament that's the lead up to the World Cup, it's called the Confederations Cup, people marched through the streets representing Cameroon, and they were wearing blackface. There was a player from Brazil named Hulk who played in the Russian domestic league for many years. He actually said he was racially harassed by a referee. So it runs deep both on the pitch and off the pitch. And that's just what we're talking about in the stadiums. You also have vigilante violence carried out by a lot of these hooligan supporter groups out in the streets. And I think that's what has a lot of people concerned. You might be able to control it in the World Cup stadiums, but out in the streets could be a very different story.
Now, last year, the Russian Soccer Federation appointed former Russian star Alexei Smertin to be the, quote, anti-racism investigator during the tournament. But we have this clip from a 2015 interview he did with the BBC, and I'd like you to take a listen to it.
There's no racism in Russia, definitely, because, you know, it doesn't exist. It's just like, I think it's just the rumors. Racism in Russia, it's like a fashion, I would say, you know, it comes from abroad, from different countries, but 10 years ago, I remember some fans, you know, can give a banana to black guys, and it was just for fun.
And for some of our listeners who may not have understood that, basically he was saying that racism is like fashion. It comes and goes. It's imported from other countries. He even mentions some fans giving a banana to a black guy, quote unquote, just for fun. Your thoughts, Jules?
Right, except the fun, so to speak, has never stopped. And it's continued on through a lot of banana throwing, like he said, was ancient history. We've seen that. We've seen monkey chanting. We've also seen subtler coded racism at Russian games, football matches, soccer matches, coded bigotry, clothing and banners that are adorned with neo-Nazi symbols, such as number 88, the Celtic cross, various runes with particular meanings to neo-Nazi groups. You've even seen the SS slogan, "My honor is loyalty," on some of the banners at these games. So Smertin is obviously just giving the sort of company line on this. What's perhaps more concerning is that FIFA, the world's governing body for soccer, is pretty much shown willful gullibility when it comes to these sort of comments from Smertin saying, oh, everything's going to be okay. The Russians have this under control, basically looking the other way, hoping for the best, and then probably hopping on their jet planes when it's all over and going to the next venue.
We're talking about the Men's World Cup with Jules Boykoff, and I want to ask our listeners, have you experienced racism in sports, either as a spectator or playing the game yourself? Tweet us at The Takeaway. Jules, I want to go back to what you just said about FIFA. I mean, what is the incentive for them to take this a lot more seriously than they appear to be? Or is there an incentive for them to take it seriously?
Sure. I think at this point in the history of the organization, there is an incentive because so many people now realize that if there were a Venn diagram for FIFA and corruption, it would essentially be a circle. I mean, Exhibit A has to be the sprawling federal corruption investigation that was announced back in May 2015 after several FIFA officials and their friends in various marketing groups were arrested at an early morning raid at a hotel in Zurich. And you've seen racketeering charges, fraud, money laundering charges leveled against people from FIFA, as well as their well-connected friends. So at this particular moment, they have a great incentive to sort of reputation wash. And they recently, and they deserve credit for this, about a year ago, they put forth some human rights provisions into their official documents. They've created a human rights advisory board. So they know that now is the time. They've been under a lot of pressure from human rights groups. So now is the time to take a little bit of action. Now, the question is, you can issue as many reports as you want. You can form as many blue ribbon commissions, hire the racism inspector like Alexei Smertin, but whether that actually translates to safety for people who are visiting Russia, not to mention the people in Russia from these marginalized groups. If you're a racial minority or you're from the LGBTQ community, those people's safety is paramount, and FIFA doesn't seem to be all that concerned with that in the long run.
I was just going to ask you, what impact do you think this is going to be, for these games? I mean, we are seeing a new wave of activism, particularly among Black American athletes here in the United States, anti-racist activism. What is your expectation for the Men's World Cup?
Well, we have had a number of players who are participating in the World Cup who've been very outspoken about racism and homophobia. Some of the very best players in the world, Paul Pogba of France, who, by the way, had monkey chants hurled at him at a friendly match in March in Russia, so it's fresh in his mind. Lionel Messi, the brilliant Argentinian goal scorer, will also be there. He's been outspoken against homophobia. So if some of this were to crop up, either inside the stadiums or outside, you have some of the very biggest names in sport, in soccer, who might be there to step up and say, no, this isn't right. And they can use their social media platforms and their huge followings around the world to raise attention to these issues. That would be my hope if this thing were to happen. And of course, everybody's hoping that you won't have these sort of attacks against marginalized populations during the World Cup or after the World Cup, for that matter.
Jules Boykoff is a former professional soccer player and professor of politics and government at Pacific University in Oregon. Jules, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tanzina.
And if you're interested in World Cup stories, you'll definitely want to catch the new WNYC Studios podcast, American Fiasco, hosted by the very funny Roger Bennett of Men in Blazers. You can now get it on any podcast app.
That was just fake news by NBC. Which gives a lot of fake news.
I called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are.
I think you've set a new bar today for being contentious with the press corps, kind of calling us losers to our faces and all that.
No, not all of you, just many of you.
All right, fine. Can you give us a question?
Don't be rude. No, I'm not going to give you a question. I'm not going to give you a question.
Can you stay categorical?
You are fake news.
President Donald Trump has been anything but subtle in his disdain for the press. Last week, we learned that during a whistleblower investigation, the Justice Department seized years of phone and email records belonging to New York Times journalist Ali Watkins. The Justice Department also arrested James Wolf, a former Senate Intelligence Committee aide, for allegedly leaking classified information to the press and lying to his investigators about contact with three reporters. The DOJ was investigating a story written by The Times' Ali Watkins that included classified information that Russian spies in 2013 had tried to recruit Carter Page, a former Trump policy advisor. But this is not the first whistleblower case under the Trump administration. It is the first time the Trump Justice Department has seized a reporter's data. Joining us now is co-founder and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, Trevor Timm. Trevor, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Trevor, so much to unpack with this story. Can you lead us through the basics of the case? Why would the DOJ and the administration seize a reporter's data, and can they do that?
Sure. So, late last week, as you mentioned, former director of security of the Senate Intelligence Committee, James Wolf, was indicted for allegedly lying to investigators about his contacts with reporters. One of those reporters was Ali Watkins, and you know, I think it's important to point out that actually James Wolf was not charged with actually leaking information to the media or classified information to the media, but just the lying aspect. But the part of this case that is even more concerning is the fact that Ali Watkins's email and phone call records were apparently seized by the Justice Department many months ago. And they go back at least a year. And this does not just include her potential conversations with Mr. Wolf. It also includes virtually every phone call and email she has made, which could include dozens and dozens of other sources that are involved in not only this potential story, but also dozens of other stories. And with journalists, it is vital that they are able to collect information and gather the news in a confidential manner, or it's impossible to convince sources to potentially come forward about information in the public interest. And so this is a escalation of the Trump administration's already worrying crackdown on leaks and could have huge implications for reporters going forward.
So we also should note here that Ali Watkins did have a 3-year relationship with James Wolf. She did not tell the New York Times that the Justice Department had seized her records for a couple months, even though she did tell the Times that she had had a relationship with Wolf. Now, if this is an inquiry that's specifically about her relationship with Wolf, how is it that the DOJ can seize all of these records and not just the ones pertaining to the issue in question?
Well, the Justice Department actually has internal guidelines about this called the so-called media guidelines. And what they essentially say is that the Justice Department is only supposed to directly target journalists as a matter of last resort, after they have exhausted all other options in an investigation, and that it's vital to continue the case. Here, it looks like that investigators had already had access to Wolf's phone itself. And so in the indictment, there are texts and evidence of phone calls between Watkins and at least three other reporters. And so it's very curious and bizarre that they would also need to go after Watkinson's information, because they seem to already have it from Wolf's end. And so that suggests to me that they may be trying to either scare Watkins and other reporters, or go after her sources from another story, because it's clear that they didn't actually need this information to get the information that they wanted, given that they already have Wolf's phone. And so that's why it's incredibly worrying. The Trump administration claims that they have dozens of other leak investigations going. So how many other reporters have they conducted surveillance on in secret that we don't actually know about yet?
Now, let's also be clear that reporters do have a duty, if you will, to disclose any conflicts of interest. For example, if I'm covering something directly and I'm in a relationship with someone who works in that field, then I have a responsibility to tell my editors and my bosses about that. Where does this fall in that? If Watkins actually did tell her employer about her relationship with Wolf, should she not be protected?
Oh, well, you know, I think that, first of all, the New York Times has said that Watkins did tell them about the relationship. It's hard to speak for previous places she was working at. But I think that's, you know, the larger issue here is the government encroachment on reporters' rights. You know, if anything, the relationship question is an ethical question, but certainly shouldn't be decided by the Justice Department and the FBI. And the larger worry here is that the Justice Department is going to use these tactics against other journalists, given that they have so many other leak investigations open, given that Trump has obviously disparaged the media virtually on a daily basis and claims that the press is the enemy of the American people. And so far, that has largely just been rhetoric. But if he is using the full weight of the Justice Department to go after journalists he doesn't like, then that would become incredibly disturbing.
But it's also something that we did see begin under the Obama administration. I don't think this is something we can blame squarely on the Trump administration in terms of the leak investigations and putting pressure on media.
No, absolutely not. And it's definitely important to point out that before the Trump administration, the Obama administration was actually the worst White House and Justice Department on press freedom since Richard Nixon. They brought a record number of leak cases, actually more prosecutions of journalist sources than all other administrations combined. They also had scandals where they had subpoenaed the phone lines of Associated Press journalists. They had read the email of a Fox News journalist, and they had even tried to subpoena Pulitzer Prize winner James Risen and almost forced him into jail. So it's true that the Obama administration really created a blueprint for which the Trump administration can work off of.
And Trevor, I want to ask this question, too, that just so our listeners are clear, journalists do not have a federal protection known as a shield law, correct?
That's correct. There is no federal protection for journalists like there are with doctors or lawyers or therapists, where they can refuse to testify in court. There are state laws that protect journalists in some cases, and also other laws in other court districts. But this is why it's really important that eventually we get a federal shield law that can hopefully prevent this type of thing from happening to begin with.
Trevor Timm is the co-founder and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. Trevor, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.